You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories.
And welcome to episode 307 of the podcast. And in this one, I chat with Eva Stepney. Eva is a research student studying for her PhD at the University of Sheffield. Her thesis is titled Obsessive Compulsive Disorder and the Foundation of Evidence-Based Practice in British Psychology, 1948 to 1990. So I got Eva on to particularly talk about an article that she published recently called Guilty Obsessions. But first we talk about her PhD research, then we go into the article Guilty Obsessions, in which we talk about the history of OCD, the history of psychoanalysis and the development of other psychotherapies such as ERP, the importance of Sigmund Freud to the early development of conceptualization of OCD, what separates OCD from phobias, how other emotions like guilt, doubt and disgust can be drivers of OCD, how Freud originally said this, but how mainstream psychiatry focused only on fear until in more recent years when the research is showing that other emotions play a role too. We discuss the idea of trauma and potential links to OCD, the history of ERP, and the conference OCD in Society, which will be happening in 2022 in London. So there's a few things I wanted to say about this episode. One is because Eva talks about, and I talk about, Sigmund Freud. Obviously, he was focused a lot on libidinal drives, i.e. things like sex come into it. So just a kind of warning for anyone, there is a little bit of that, but we don't go into much detail. And it was also, just to continue on Sigmund Freud, he can, as I say in the episode, come across like the butt of joke sometimes, and definitely among certain therapies and in society more generally, but there's a lot he said that still holds true today, and there's a lot that does not hold true. But even so, we wouldn't be where we are with psychiatry and psychotherapy generally if it wasn't for people like him. And they were starting in a time where they had no one else. They had no original research to build on. They were building the foundation, so they were going to make mistakes, but he had the courage to make those mistakes. So I just want to take a second to acknowledge that. And in the very early days of this podcast, or 6 years ago, I also, based on something I read in an OCD book, kind of make a flippant point about Sigmund Freud. So obviously I regret that, but I didn't know better. Now I do. And yeah, you know, he was the first person, as Eva says, to conceptualize OCD, to, as far as we know, to make an attempt to conceptualize OCD as sort of obsessions and compulsions. So he really got where we are today. He got all of that going. And I think that's brilliant. So yeah, at least in the field of OCD and the work he initially did, whether it was right or wrong, got us to where we are. So that is worthy of a shout out. And the last thing I'll mention is we do talk a lot about mainstream psychiatry moving towards fear in a large period of time. However, psychology has now started to move back in recent years towards acknowledging other emotions outside of just fear and anxiety, you know, and that's come up in my podcast before, you know. So I think this episode is more about how there was that gap of time where those emotions just went missing from British psychology when Sigmund Freud originally conceptualized that it's these other emotions as well as anxiety that really drives OCD. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the work that I do. NoCD offers affordable, effective, convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. If you wanted to find out more about their therapy services and whether they take your insurance currently, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/COCD stories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you as always to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And I hope this episode with Eva is a little different and a little interesting, or a lot interesting. I certainly enjoyed the conversation. So without further ado, here is Eva.
Welcome to the show, Eva.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And I got you on because obviously we're working on a conference together, which we'll talk about later, but also largely because of an article you wrote called Guilty Obsessions, which we'll get into shortly. But I guess initially, just be good to explain who you are and the PhD research you're doing.
So my name's Eva, and I am at the moment in my second year of a PhD in the Department of History at the University of Sheffield. And I'm looking at kind of the historical formation of obsessive compulsive disorder as a distinctly psychological category in 20th century British psychology. And I'm kind of looking at the entwined relationship between OCD and the development of British clinical psychology, so the kind of emergence of behaviorism and then the shift to cognitive behavior therapy. And my current research is kind of built upon my master's thesis, which was looking at obsessional thoughts in early 20th century British psychiatry. I kind of got into this field of work through my own experiences with obsessional thoughts and with OCD more generally. And that kind of linked up with my passion for history and particularly like the history of psychiatry and the history of psychology. So that's kind of who I am and what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's awesome. And your master's, was that at Sheffield as well?
No, it was at Birkbeck. So master's was actually specifically like the history of medicine and psychiatry.
Okay.
So that was at Birkbeck.
Yeah. And the master's didn't specifically drill down to OCD.
My thesis did.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
My thesis was looking at obsessional thoughts, how they were kind of thought of in psychoanalysis, what happened when psychoanalysis entered mainstream British psychiatry. And then there was kind of this strange phenomenon, which in the middle of the 20th century, people with obsessional thoughts were being treated a lot by psychosurgery, so by lobotomy, where they were having little kind of metal devices put into their brains, which is very horrible. But I was interested in how we got there and what had to change in the conception of obsessions to enable us or enable psychiatrists to think that that was a worthwhile treatment.
Yeah. And what was the answer to that, if it's a quick one, or it can be long?
I mean, generally, it was a shift away from psychoanalysis to a desire to kind of root understandings of the mind in the body. And lobotomy and psychosurgery obviously is a very physical treatment. It was also this idea that people with obsessions were extremely difficult to treat. They often ended up in psychiatric hospitals for a very, very long time. So there was this perception that, you know, we'll almost just try anything. Okay. But also I looked at how the kind of like metaphors of circuits, how there's kind of this idea that in psychiatry at the time, that our brains are kind of made up of these circuits, and in obsessional disorders, they just go round and round and round. And if you kind of stick this device in it, you can almost disrupt those circuits. Yeah, it's quite an archaic way of thinking about the mind, but
yeah,
it was popular.
Yeah, well, equally, it kind of makes sense. It's wrong, but it you know, at first glance, you see why they came to that conclusion.
Definitely.
Yeah, let's just interrupt the pattern. Which you kind of do with ERP. You are kind of interrupting the pattern to a point by changing behavior, but they obviously tried it through surgery, which is
there are connections between the models, the idea of kind of a conditioned fear response that goes round and round and round and round, whether that's a behavioral fear response that's kind of understood in terms of learning, or whether that's kind of understood through these metaphors of circuits. So yeah, like you say, they're a similar conception of obsessions driven by fear.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to get onto that in a bit, actually, when we talk about guilty obsessions. But I think just to spend a couple of minutes on psychoanalysis, and a lot of it started obviously in Vienna, but also in the UK in the early 1900s. I always get my centuries wrong because it's never, and obviously Freud in the late 1800s, I think, conceptualized obsessional neurosis, right? Or started to talk about obsessions.
Yeah, late 19th century.
Oh, late 19th. Yeah. See, there you go. So I'm thinking 18. To me, that 18. Means, you know, so that's why history was not a strength of mine.
1894, 19th century, 1800s. It's always on my head.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So, yeah, I get confused by that. But yeah. So he, you know, we often, I think sometimes, yeah, in maybe the more CBT circles, not everyone, but can look down at psychoanalysis, you know, but actually there's a lot we need to be thankful for, because CBT wouldn't be here without it, most likely. And Freud, definitely, sometimes he can be a bit of the butt of a joke, but actually to this day, there's still many things that hold true. There's a lot that don't equally, but, you know, the stuff that is. And I think what he said initially or partly about OCD was very insightful. So maybe, yeah, and I guess that's starting to bring me into your article, so I don't want to say anything else, but is there anything generally on early psychoanalysis that you think was important for OCD?
Well, I think that Freud is incredibly important for kind of later developments of OCD, because he actually distinguished obsessional neuroses as a separate disorder from other things. So prior to Freud, kind of the symptoms of repetitive thoughts, repetitive behaviors to an extent, although it's a murky field when it comes to behaviors, because there were a lot of behavioral disorders. Anyway, basically what Freud did is he took this huge conceptual mess of obsessions being a kind of sub-symptom of loads and loads of other disorders. So you had, you know, obsessional melancholia, you had things like kleptomania, you had all these kind of disorders. And what Freud did is said, look, I am going to identify a disorder, obsessional neurosis, based solely on obsessions and rituals. So he actually created a single diagnosis, and that wasn't the case before. So in that sense, he's fundamental in that actually just being this separate category.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, well, you know, I kind of knew that, but as you said it so articulately, he was the birth of OCD treatment.
Yeah.
At least in the way we see it now, not the treatment, but the diagnostic label of OCD. Mm-hmm. Obviously it was obsessional neurosis, but semantics.
So he was pretty important, and I think his kind of, I mean, he had two theories of obsessive neuroses, his kind of initial one and then his later one.
The later one's more accurate, right? At least
which I outline in the article. So the first one is kind of based on ideas of kind of repressed trauma, and the second one is to do with his ideas of kind of intra-psychic conflict, so that everybody has an ego and an id and a superego, and there's kind of a conflict between the ego and the superego. They clash against each other in some respects, and this kind of can produce thoughts as a kind of defense mechanism. I often think about the like term ego dystonic that we still have in cognitive therapy, and that being very much rooted in this idea of the kind of socialized mind being resistant to the kind of infantile instinctive ego.
The sort of inner animal, you know, that's kind of in us somewhere, in the more primitive part of the brain. I agree, and I'm not against that formulation of his. But the original one, he very much focused it on sexual trauma from what I remember, which obviously I disagree with, because that discludes every other type of trauma. That was early Freud, where it was much more about drives and sex. But the research is now showing that for some people with OCD, trauma plays a big part. Maybe I don't think it's been defined as the cause, but OCD happening after a traumatic event, there's studies that are showing this. So in some way, his early one was also at least partly true, his early theory.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's so much research now showing that kind of trauma, particularly traumatic experiences, create like a vulnerability in people. And as you said, for a lot of people, that vulnerability can express in kind of perhaps like increased sensitivity towards certain thoughts, or actually in the production of particular thoughts and behaviors themselves. So, yeah.
Okay, awesome. So let's get into Guilty Obsessions, your article, and anyone that wants to read it, because I think you've done clearly put a lot of work in into researching it. I definitely found it interesting. So I'll link to that in the show notes. But yeah, Guilty Obsessions, what's it about, the article?
So the article is about the fact that in contemporary understandings of OCD, there is beginning to be this kind of recognition that anxiety is perhaps not the most dominant emotion or the most dominant affect associated with the disorder. And clinical literature is starting to talk about things like guilt, doubt, self-reproach, and these kind of other emotional states being extremely important. And this is actually really obvious in the move. So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in America, which is kind of the main diagnostic system they have there, has OCD in an anxiety disorder category in DSM-4. And then in the fifth edition, the new edition, they move it into a separate category of OCD-related disorders. And part of this is because there is a recognition that anxiety is not the sole emotion. Well, it's not that it's not like important, it's just that it's not characteristic for everybody. And so I kind of knew this in the back of my head, because I'd kind of kept up with contemporary changes in definitions of OCD and changing symptom criteria. And then when I was reading Freud for my master's dissertation, I noticed that he distinguished between obsessions and phobias based on this difference of emotion. So he says phobias are always characterized by anxiety, and that's what makes phobias phobias. Whereas obsessions, they can be characterized by anxiety, but largely they are characterized by guilt and self-reproach. And he says that, you know, they're characterized by guilt because they are the person reacting in a kind of the socialized aspect of a person reacting to the kind of more animalistic aspect of their psyche, which for him is very much associated with kind of libidinal drives, but that's Freud. So the article is looking at how British psychiatry incorporated Freud's model of obsessional neurosis and how they actually got rid of the guilt aspect of it, which was so fundamental to his characterization of the symptom. And I'm kind of arguing that this decision then set the kind of path for obsessional neurosis in Britain and the kind of clinical discussions of obsessions more broadly to develop along this line of prioritizing anxiety and fear rather than guilt.
I think it's interesting what you say. I mean, phobias make sense, right? So, you know, I wouldn't say I have a phobia of maybe anything, I don't know, but definitely not of snakes. I mean, I guess they trigger my fight or flight. So yeah. I was in a, but I wouldn't say it's a phobia, but I was in a lake swimming. This was a couple months ago and it was still fairly warm. And at that point I was only sort of ankle deep in this water. And I looked down and there's this little, what looked like a toy snake kind of floating in the water about a meter from my feet. And I'm thinking that looks like a really realistic toy. Like some kids just left that there. And then I suddenly see this little tongue flick.
Oh my God.
And I just freak out. My fight or flight system kicks in and I'm gone, you know, and trying to like, it's like a scene from Jaws. I'm trying to clear all the like kids and adults that are around away. Cause I thought it was an adder, which is obviously the only poisonous snake we have here, as far as I'm aware, or venomous. Anyway, so my point to this long-winded story is that I didn't feel guilt, disgust, or shame when I saw that snake. I just felt fear and anxiety, you know. But often when we think about OCD,
for many people, well, you know, with the clients I work with, anxiety is pretty much there all of the time.
Yeah.
But it's not the only thing. Like, and for some of them, guilt or shame is as powerful a driver as the anxiety to do the rituals.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree. And it's interesting you brought up the fight or flight thing, because in the article, I'm kind of saying that the reason that British psychiatrists changed Freud's version of obsessional neuroses, where guilt was prevalent, is because that they already had a biological and evolutionary model for fear, which was this idea that the brain is kind of like a hierarchy of evolutionary developments, with kind of fear, fight or flight kind of mechanisms at the bottom. Whereas like for Freud, so that was one of the reasons. The other reason was that for Freud, the guilt aspect was very related to the sex aspect, you know? So like the socialized aspect of the self is very resistant to these thoughts because we're taught not to be inappropriate about sex. Yeah. And these thoughts for Freud were often very heavily to do with sex. Mm-hmm. And in Britain, this was just unacceptable. So they thought, you know what, we'll just have Freud's model of like intrapsychic conflict, a conflict between social and evolutionary, but we'll base it on fear. And like you said, then that kind of enables the mechanism of phobias to kind of become a catch-all for obsessions. But in my current research, I'm actually very interested in how this was kind of further progressed with behavioral models. Because with the development of like exposure response prevention, psychologists in Britain, they really relied on kind of the learning model of stimulus response, which is very much like you said, you know, yeah, there's a fear of snakes. The snakes is the stimulus. The fear is the response. Like the fear is what drives a response, and the response perhaps is avoidance or fleeing the situation. So that's kind of the model that they had. So when they saw people, for example, repeatedly washing their hands, they said, okay, fear of contamination leads to response, which is washing your hands, but those two things are connected by fear. And that enabled kind of a quite a neat mechanism to develop for understanding OCD. Yeah. And exposure response was about disrupting the connection between stimulus and response, which is connected by fear, disrupting it by exposing someone to what they fear and preventing them from carrying out the response. So you can see how in that model, fear is absolutely essential, because, I mean, the behavioral psychologists, they originally worked with animals. They didn't have a way of assessing animal guilt. Guilt was messy. Guilt was complicated. Guilt involves meaning and relationships and narrative. And how do you expose somebody to what they feel guilty about? Like that doesn't, it didn't fit into that kind of...
It wasn't neat.
And also the model, the behavioral model for obsessions was, like you kind of alluded to, was very much based on the behavioral model for phobias.
Well, I mean, just to jump in quickly, there's a couple of things come to my mind. Is one is I think what you said just sums up sometimes the problem with, I don't want to say science, but research, because we can only measure what we have like a measuring stick for, you know? And back in those days, they were measuring for anxiety because it was more easily measured and monitored in animals. But because they maybe couldn't figure out or didn't want to or didn't notice how to, or didn't come to their brains to try, and how could we monitor or measure guilt, it just got forgot. So it's like, so we based all this stuff on this science, which actually was only really looking at a part of the picture, not the whole thing. That doesn't really bring, it's just always something on, like, I do research myself, or have done recently, and I'm obviously supportive of research, but I think we don't often talk about it. You know, how do you ever measure God? You know, that's the stereotypical one. I'm not saying I believe, but like, I'm not saying I don't believe, because we just don't have any tools to figure out if he or she is there or not, you know?
Exactly. And I think this is kind of the bulk of my actual PhD research, which is looking at how the methods employed by psychologists often serve to exclude certain phenomena. And that's not saying, that's not meant to be like a criticism. It's just meant to say, like you said, that science is perhaps, or psychological science is largely based on quantification and based on kind of experimental, replicable research. And that requires people to make, or the investigators to make decisions about what to include and what to exclude. And I kind of start my PhD by looking at how the behaviorists divided between compulsions and ruminations. And they said that ruminative thoughts were not observable and not observable in animals and not visibly modifiable. So we'll just focus on behaviors. So exposure response prevention was developed solely in regard to compulsive behaviors. And those compulsive behaviors were embedded in a framework of fear. And the thoughts were the messy part. So for example, I think, you know, when you have a model which says this, the stimulus is fear of contamination and the response is washing, that model doesn't allow for perhaps, you know, why is this person scared of contamination? Is it because they feel guilty in case they contaminate others, or is it doubt about previous contamination? So this is where, you know, the guilt and the doubt comes in as perhaps these additional elements that become excluded from the story.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did they ever talk about emotions, like in those early days of the research around behaviorism? Was it like, we acknowledge they're there, but they're not important? Or was it they just didn't acknowledge it? Did you ever come across anything that kind of explained that?
It was that we acknowledge they're there, but they're
not driving it.
Not, they don't fit within our methodological requirements at the moment. Because... Okay. So I look a lot of the work of Stanley Rachman, who's doing the kind of early experiments at the Maudsley. And he does write papers which are entirely theoretical, which explore kind of ideas of responsibility and subjectivity and ambiguity. But they're very theoretical and they're not published in like the main journals. In the main journals, he just like pretends that all of his theoretical work doesn't exist almost. Although the article on guilty obsessions is very much looking at the early 20th century as kind of the starting point of this phenomena of British psychiatrists privileging fear in their discussions of obsessions, in Britain we really see, because of the emphasis on science and kind of visibly observable, quantifiable aspects of human behavior, we see this kind of focus on fear continue, which I think has had profound implications today, because even though in cognitive psychology we have concepts like inflated responsibility the ability to deal with the inability to deal with uncertainty and so on, in because OCD has been in like an anxiety disorders category for so long, I think kind of if it's a non-specialist treatment, like, you know, general practitioner, primary care identification of OCD, or even people are trying to identify in themselves, if there's not really clear, visibly observable behaviors, and if anxiety isn't the dominant emotion, I think people probably get missed. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Potentially. Yeah, yeah. I think that maybe, obviously, I have no evidence for it, but I think it's a good hypothesis. And I think also, maybe even those that go to specialists sometimes, or even just generalists, but generalists that are trained and understand OCD, if they're very much stuck on the anxiety approach, what else are they missing by not focusing on that patient's or client's guilt, disgust, shame, whatever? Because I guess what comes to my mind, and this then makes it more like non-CBT-ish in the form that, okay, if I think about if a client has a lot of guilt around obsession, it could be that because it's a taboo obsession, it's generally just egodystonic and against what society says is normal, and therefore they feel shame about having it, which fits perfectly with CBT. But then also you go, why is there a lot of guilt in this person? Is there something in their past that, not to say trauma, but like, you know, maybe it's a divorce and they felt in some way that they were responsible for their parents splitting up, and does that link? Mm-hmm. And I have seen in some clients that there is a coincidence in timing, you know, between certain events, yeah, and guilt and stuff like that.
And also, yeah, and I mean, I'm not sure what the difference between guilt and shame is kind of phenomenologically. I don't have any authority on that, but I know that there's been a fair amount of research on kind of shame as the legacy of trauma. I was saying that there was a lot of research, I think, that looks at shame as kind of the affect associated with particular kind of childhood traumas or adult traumas, particularly in the kind of violence area. I don't want to obviously go into anything too explicitly. But yeah, so I think that the kind of looking at things solely in terms of a simple connection probably misses this meaning of why these thoughts do arouse such shame and guilt in certain people and not others. And like you said, there can be kind of broader meanings behind this. And also the dominant first line gold standard treatment in this country for OCD is ERP. Mm-hmm. And ERP is an approach which modifies anxiety. So I think that's something that's really important when we are considering the other emotional states associated with OCD, is that our main treatment is focuses on anxiety. So perhaps we can think more about what helps. You know, I don't want to criticize ERP or criticize or kind of undermine those that have very strong anxious responses to particular thoughts. It's just about kind of paying attention to what else there is.
And look, I with every client I have or have had with OCD, I have used ERP as part of the treatment, so I'm absolutely for it, but I'm also for that it's not the whole thing, you know. And that's just not even my opinion. That's science. You know, there's or research. You look at there's a study came out this year that kind of split meta-analysis of 36. Yeah. I don't want to go into that one in too much detail, but like, obviously they showed it works great for some people, but even for the people it works great for, it's maybe not the whole picture, but there's also a portion of people that doesn't seem to work for.
Exactly. You know? And I think OCD is a very complex disorder, and I think there are many nuances within it. You know, there are some people that have more thought-based kind of manifestations of the disorder. There are some people that have more ritual-based. There are some people that have both. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, in my own experience of kind of intrusive thoughts and obsessions, is that they're very, very associated with depression. My thoughts get kind of more persistent, more intrusive when I'm depressed. And that's kind of when they first emerged as well. Okay. And I think that is very shrouded in kind of the guilt shame aspect. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of another element that gets quite sidelined in the kind of early research on OCD. Again, because until cognitive behavioral therapy, there wasn't really a kind of distinct psychological model for depression. Because as I said, the kind of early psychological models were based around anxiety because they were from behavior therapy. I mean, from behavioral theory.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you know, I don't ask you too much about your story, but if when I said about, you know, some of my clients, that there's some that, like, there doesn't seem to be anything in their past, be it trauma or just negative experiences, that may have caused anything. And sometimes that's it. And we just go straight ahead with behaviorism and maybe some ACT and CFT, compassion focused therapy. But then others, sometimes there's this, like I said, it doesn't have to be any big trauma, but yeah, a rupture in the family that to the person was experienced as traumatic. It was tough. They were young and da, 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 da. And sometimes if we overlook that, what does that mean? How is that affecting their interaction with ERP? Are they adhering to it? And even that, are they still left with something at the end of ERP? Like, the fire's down, and that's wonderful. As in, the symptoms are reduced. That's amazing. But if there's more to go, like, we need to think about that part of the person too, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I often felt this with kind of satiation training or habituation, where kind of repeating a thought over and over again and almost doing ERP kind of internally. This is another kind of interesting factor that a lot of the kind of conceptualization of obsessional thoughts is based on the behavioral model of compulsions, because that came first. Is that, you know, it gets rid of the symptom, but then for me anyway, a new thought just emerged. Because when I first developed, well, in hindsight, I would see it as kind of obsessionality, but at the time it was just anxiety. I had a particular traumatic event and had really, really bad depersonalization. And I started obsessively worrying that things didn't exist and that my parents were robots. And that's like all I thought about, because it was partly based on the fact that I was so depersonalized that the world didn't look real. But then after I'd had therapy for that and kind of become accustomed to those thoughts, and they'd reduced because I'd just kind of driven the affect out of them through constant repetition, so exposure. A few years later, I had like an intrusive harm thought, and that came, you know, launched into this whole other period of being really, really unwell and period of being really in distress, because it was a new thought. It had a slightly different emotion with it. I felt more kind of guilty, disgusted. I didn't recognize it. So even though, like, in hindsight, I can see those experiences as perhaps like a similar way of thinking.
Yeah.
They both, you know, just because I'd recovered from the first, the second was just as severe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So yeah, it kind of tricked you in, which is, I think, experience a lot of people have. Like, it just, they're seasoned veterans when it comes to this type of therapy, but then they get tricked by another way by OCD, and it's, tricked is probably an unfair term, you know what I mean? It wears a different mask and it's confusing for the person, and they feel kind of disabled again or unable to respond.
And I think in all of the experiences that I've had since then, this kind of, they all come back to this inability to deal with uncertainty. And I think that's becoming also recognized alongside this guilt and responsibility stuff as kind of a key motivation that links particular thoughts. And what's been very helpful kind of moving forward is just with whatever thought, this acceptance, you know, well, whether it's true or not, it's like, I can't actually know.
Yeah.
I can't work it out. You can't work things out cognitively. Like,
no.
Yeah, so just accept the uncertainty, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I do think ERP does work on those other emotions too, to a point, because you're facing disgust, or you're facing shame, and you're surviving it, you know, in the same way you survive anxiety, and then your brain learns, or maybe I'm not that disgusting, or maybe I don't shouldn't be as ashamed as I feel. You know, I'm not saying this is consciously happening, but in the background. Because something I found fascinating when I was reading a Viktor Frankl article, and obviously he created logotherapy. And in 1920, I remember there's a bit in 1929, he wrote about paradoxical intention, which is, it's not ERP, but it looks a damn damn a lot alike, ELP, if that doesn't make any sense. But anyway, and basically it was like he said, if you're worried about having a heart attack, I think he literally wrote this. I'll try and dig it out and put it in the show notes. He said, run in the street and try and have a heart attack. Mm. His whole thing was basically exposing yourself to the thing. It's a paradoxical intention. You don't want to have a heart attack. So the paradox is you go and try and have one in the middle of the high street. It didn't necessarily have the response prevention bit, but it was the exposure bit. And that was 1929, before ERP was a thing.
I think even in Greek texts, you have a degree of,
stoicism.
Roman texts, are fascinating anyway, because, there's a lot of stuff that looks a lot like cognitive therapy as well, especially amongst like the Stoics and kind of techniques that they had for dealing with melancholia and so on. But there is, I think, don't quote me on this, but definitely research it if you're interested. I think there is evidence of kind of that exposure technique being used in kind of ancient Greek texts. I think it is quite, it makes sense, and I'm not just, as a historian, I'm very conscious of saying things that make sense when they make sense to us because we already know them. But I know as a child I had a strong sense that I should do things that I was scared of, like hold spiders, for example, when I was, because I don't know, I just knew that if I didn't, I would avoid them. And I think, there's something almost kind of
innate,
perhaps not innate, but that's learned over a long period of time. That's kind of grown up in our species. I'm starting to sound like
no, I get it. Yeah, where I was saying it's kind of like biologically in us. You're saying it's been learned over a few thousand years and passed through us. Interesting.
But again, OCD I think is so multifaceted and so complicated. That would never just be the whole story.
No, I agree. just also thinking of like rites of passage, right? There are many cultures that still do it, but definitely it was more common the further you go back in time. For the young boy leaving the tribe, having to go kill something and, survive in the dark and bring it back. Like, imagine how terrifying that must have been, but how confident or maybe traumatized you would have been coming back. We always think of them as confident. I'm sure there are a few traumatized young warriors that came back or eaten by tigers. But I guess it was facing fear was much larger part of society. And now the idea of ERP seems quite strange to people when they first hear about it. Why would you face your fears? Mm-hmm. Whereas historically it was a natural part of human existence,
Yeah, exactly.
Also women giving birth. like even now it's the unknown, but 2000 years ago giving birth, that was a real uncertainty. There was a high chance of death,
I mean, I know you know his work, but Elvis Gomez has written a lot about this in his thesis about kind of how we almost live in a there's kind of, we rely on certainty a lot, whether that's kind of like authenticity of identity. We need to know who we are. We need to be able to describe exactly who we are. And we need this kind of quest for certainty is almost that, like the paradox of our age, which is like in OCD sufferers, it leads to a hell of a lot of uncertainty. Because we perceive everyone else around us as being certain. And almost as OCD sufferers, but also as society at large, we need to become more accustomed to just not knowing.
Yeah.
Not being able to predict and not being able to know ourselves.
Yeah.
it's almost impossible.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder if that's, and maybe you have an answer to this, that's just like where society becomes more and more certain in that I order something on Amazon tells me it's coming on Tuesday. It comes on Tuesday. They never give you a rough exact time, but so that's uncertain. But you know, I it's coming, right? I know my electricity is going to be pretty consistent in the UK, like all of this stuff. Maybe the fuel, not so much at the minute, but
yeah,
I guess. And then again, further you go back in time, there were certainties, but way less than there are now. So have we been groomed into like expecting certainty?
Yeah. I mean, there are quite a few scholars in the social sciences that actually conceptualize OCD as kind of an extension of modernity, an extension of kind of, you know, like hyper rationality, hyper capitalist, hyper kind of, hyper modern, but which is like a very interesting analysis. But I think what OCD almost does is to expose us to the fact that at some level we are aware that we cannot control this certainty. So people with obsessions and compulsions are kind of attuned to this sense that the world is not certain, that it's messy, that it's ambiguous and it's complex. So actually, in that sense, kind of OCD tells us a lot, like tells us something very important and very interesting.
Yeah.
Which kind of brings back to Freud, this kind of the relationship between the self and society.
I mean, there's still so much there that needs to be unpacked. I will say, on just to reassure people that, like you said earlier on, like the DSM-4, OCD was an anxiety disorder. DSM-5, it's its own thing because of, and that's based on research. You know, I don't know when it was, in recent years, maybe you know, that did say that there were other emotions like shame, guilt, disgust. So it's definitely disseminating through OCD therapists and generalists. Yeah. So that's just to reassure people. I just thought your article was really interesting because we had the answer 120 years ago, you know, and then we forgot it. And then it was only the last like 10, 15 years that we remembered it again or found it for the first time. And really, it was just, you know, I'll be interested to see if they quote Freud, the people that started.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know if I'm going to have time to do it in my PhD, but I would like to write something at some point about how when psychologists start approaching the kind of like messiness of ruminations and the messiness of kind of emotion, that they do then rely on a lot of Freud's early developments around obsessional neuroses. Okay. So like when they focus on compulsions, they kind of reject it. And then when, like I said earlier, ego dystonic, very, very Freudian principle. Very like the ego, that's you know, that's part of the Freudian mind. And this idea of, you know, central to Freud was the overvaluation of one's thought. You value your thoughts too highly, that you attribute too much meaning to them. That comes back again,
absolutely, to CBT. Don't believe everything you think.
Exactly. Everyone has these thoughts. Again, Freudian.
And how id, ego, super ego. I'm not saying I 100% agree with it in the case of OCD, but quite simplistically, you can understand OCD by looking at it. You've got the id, which is like the more animalistic part of your brain, which is like throwing these horrible thoughts at you. You've got you, the ego, and then you've got your super ego, which is the OCD, the hyperconscious, like moral, trying to like balance out that crazy id, and then you're in the middle, just tortured between these two poles.
Exactly. And I think that's interesting as well, because for Freud, the superego was obviously very entangled with society and kind of like the socialized aspects, and almost like OCD is kind of entangled with the morality that's embedded in particular kind of like social relations, and what will people think of us, or what will people think of me if I have this thought, and you know, that's a very social thing to think.
Absolutely. That's awesome. So is there, I guess lastly then, is there anything you wanted to say else on this article before we move on? Or guilt generally?
I think just the guilt, shame and disgust If you look at kind of phenomenological or kind of experience-based descriptions of OCD across the latter half of the 20th century and then obsession neuroses in the first half, you know, they're very, very present. So just to listeners, don't be confused that you're, if you think you're the only one having these kind of feelings, and don't be afraid to kind of bring them up in therapy, because psychologists and psychiatrists are clearly becoming like more accepting of this idea in recent decades. So
yeah, I agree.
And that it's not simple.
No, it's not. It's a big puzzle, and we have many of the pieces, and those pieces help a lot of people, but there's still a few pieces to slot in.
Yeah.
Which I guess for researchers is a happy place to be, because it gives them plenty of exciting work. But so, you know, you're organising the OCD in Society event. So the first year was run by Alvis in London, Queen Mary. Then it was run by Matt at University of Michigan.
Yeah.
Last year, that was online because of was the pandemic. No, this year, wasn't it? Sorry, this year.
Yeah, it was this year.
Yeah, there was 2020 was missed, and it was 2019 was Alvis's one. So you're running it this year. I'm helping you to a point, but you're doing most of it. It's your baby. yeah, just what do you want to say or share about the event OCD in Society?
Well, it's going to be happening on May the 28th, 2022. So if you're interested, put that date in your diary. It's a Saturday, so hopefully no one will be working, although I know modern working practices. And basically the theme of this year's OCD and Society conference is theory and practice. And we're very interested in having people speak about kind of the role of practice in OCD. So kind of bodily practices, spatial practices, regulatory practices, clinical practices, linguistic practices, all these different things. And generally the conference is about bringing anthropological, historical, artistic, sociological, and kind of humanities-based approaches to the study of OCD, and creating a space where alternative perspectives can be discussed alongside lived experience. So we will be circulating the call for papers for the conference and the call for contributions in the next week. And registration should be open in March. So please keep your eye out. And Stu will be doing a podcast at the conference, and OCD stories will be represented there. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you. So when this episode is live, so those of you hearing it now, where will they be at if they want to sign up, submit their papers and a talk, where would they do that? Because they can do it right now. Those that are listening will be able to do it right now because it's published later on.
There's the OCD and Society website.
So yeah, so those that are interested in submitting papers for a talk, the link will be in the show notes, which you can find at theocdstories.com. But yeah, I'm happy to be a part of it, and great to see that it's continued, you know, with Matt last year and now you, because I think it's a very open-minded conference.
Yeah.
And it's a conference about having a discussion. It's not trying to share certainty or any facts, quote, in speech marks. And those conferences are important, don't get me wrong, but I think there also needs to be that open-minded conference that's questioning things and exploring and looking down different avenues. So it's great to see this is continuing.
Exactly. And we have a great keynote speaker lined up who I won't share yet. Okay. But
nice.
Yeah, keep an eye out.
Okay, cool. Okay, so you pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self. What'd you tell her?
Okay, so that was 7 years ago. Trying to think what I was doing in my 20s. I think I was pretty depressed, to be honest. Okay. I think I was pretty lying in bed. I think I would say that things feel more stable in your late 20s, and don't give up, and don't think that you need to be perfect or certain in this world, just accept that you can't control everything. I think that's what I would say. Nice. Stop trying to control everything, except that you can't. The world is messy.
I like that. And you've got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard?
The world is messy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I would like.
Yeah, there's no simple answers.
No simple answers. Yeah. Simple answers just drive, trying to achieve simple answers just drive you down rabbit holes.
Like that. Okay, and lastly, is there anything else you wish you would have shared today?
Today?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure in a kind of classic style, as soon as we end the podcast, I'll be like, oh, I wish I said this, or I wish I said this. But generally, I hope it's been a interesting and thought-provoking conversation.
Yeah, I hope so.
And if anybody wants to get in touch with me about any of my research, then please feel free.
I'll put some stuff in the show notes, so just send me, everyone go there. Well, look, thank you, Eva, for your time. And it was an awesome conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
hopefully we made some sense. You did. Hopefully I mean,
I'm not sure I did, but hopefully. Thanks, G.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast.
And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.